It's episode 9 of the Vader Podcast Studio Confessions. Imagine walking into a musical job centre with a CV that reads Senseless Things, Vent 414, Muse, Delacota, Gorillaz, Lily Allen and The Streets. Well,
yes.
I'm sat opposite the very man, a multi-instrumentalist, and now producer and recently now owner of Decatone Studios.
That's
in
right.
London.
Yeah.
Can I have a very warm welcome for Mr. Morgan Nichols?
Oh, good morning.
Good morning to you.
And, and what a lovely morning it is.
It's a beautiful morning.
It's a stunner.
It's a stunner. Yeah. And you're here at Vader with me at this moment in time. And we're here, we've started a Vent 414 record.
Yeah, very exciting. Yeah,
which is
really exciting. It's great. It's a lovely thing to come back to something after so long and it feel so natural.
Yeah.
And fun.
Yeah, the first day, the last session, the way just immediately good music was happening.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I was pretty much terrified. I haven't played like that or written like that, just straight off the bat. It's not something people really do an awful lot of, I don't think.
No, not these days.
Well, I haven't, and probably not since, for like, I don't know, 20 years or so, because everything's sort of... I don't know, I've done sort of more recording stuff with other bands who have everything worked out. And so apart from like doing the odd overdub here and there and maybe the odd bass session, from a writing point of view, it's quite unusual to have the luxury as well of doing it like that way. And no, it's great. But yeah, it's slightly nervous, you know, going straight off the bat, you know. But it was amazing how quickly it all came together.
I think everybody was nervous.
Yeah.
And between the three of you, you kind of, you've got experience, which is cool because I think that's the whole thing about when you love it.
Yeah.
You don't ever stop being nervous. You'd be nervous if you went into that situation if you were 17.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously you're 30 now and so
mentally
so I mean, how long is it, when did you do, because the last album, I mean, this is a funny thing, I was thinking about this the other day, it's a kind of a pressure for me because the first Vent album is one of my favorite albums ever and it was produced by one of my hero producers, of course, Steve Albini, who sadly passed away.
So
I mean, when did you track that album?
You know what, I couldn't tell you. You'd have to ask Miles for dates and all that stuff. We'll have to fill that bit in later. It was a long time ago.
I mean, I saw you play live on that tour in 96.
Yeah, so it would have been around that. Yeah, it would have been
95,
around
96.
Yeah. Well, we actually, Miles and I started working on tracks quite a bit before that. It would have been maybe a few years before that even, because... it all started off where he'd got in touch and he'd written all these stuff, a lot of tracks on demo on cassette, on a 4-track, and so he'd called me up and said, "Oh, could I just play in a few things and see how it goes?" And so I had my own setup at home, and sent him just me noodling as usual on stuff, which he really liked, and it went from there. And from that we got, you know, Pete came on board, and then we went to a residential studio where we recorded the whole album prior to Steve, the Steve session at Abbey Road, and we did the whole thing on ADAT. And I can't for the life of me remember the studio. It's down near Brighton somewhere.
Not Brighton Electric.
No, it was outside. It was sort of on the way to Brighton, and it was, I think it was where Status Quo used to rehearse. And it felt like it. And it looked like it. It was great. It was really fun. But we were there for like a couple of months. Or I was, just sort of having fun. But yeah, so that's where it started. So that would have been, the year before that we did the actual album.
Nearly 30. It would probably be like pretty much 30 years between the two records.
That's
quite a wait.
It's quite a wait.
Yeah. So, but you've been like... You were born into a musical family.
Yeah, I didn't stand a chance, really.
No.
But it was on my dad's side. My dad, Billy, was a singer-songwriter in the 60s. And his my granddad, his dad, was in the wartime band, the Squadronaires. Which, weirdly enough, there was a sort of synergy with that, in that we found out years and years later that my granddad, well, he was in the Squadron Airs, was the other guy who was in the band was Pete Townsend's dad. And so my, which we didn't know, they didn't know at the time, you know, they only worked this out years later, so it was quite nice.
That's bizarre.
And obviously, my dad's got, we go way back with the Townsends and the Who sort of family, really. Mm. My mum went to art school with Pete's first wife, Karen. And then we used to go on holiday and all that sort of stuff. So Dad was singer-songwriter in the 60s, Billy Nichols, and he was signed to the Immediate label, Andrew Oldham's label, and which was kind of short-lived. He did a great record called Would You Believe? Is it? I can't remember now. He did a couple of albums, but the first one was it had all, like, the Small Faces and P.P. Arnold and all those sort of, it was around that sort of time.
Yeah.
And but they only pressed a few, a little run, and it's now worth a fortune. If anyone sees it in a charity shop, grab it, because it's worth, like, a few quid.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Your father wrote a Leo Sayer song, didn't he?
He's written a few over the years, a couple of classics. Yeah,
I love Leo Sayer.
Yeah. he wrote a few sort of classic ballads, I suppose, in the '70s. One was called "I Can't Stop Loving You."
Yeah.
And that did well. And that's paid a few bills over the years. So. Yeah. You only need the one, apparently. And that's he's got one.
Is that where your Christmas bicycles came from?
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah.
So do you have I've got a couple of friends whose parents, they were born into the music industry, and they have their first early memories of studios of being like 3 years old at the back of a control room with a load of toys while legendary records are being made around them.
Well, funny, it's a weird one with my dad, because it was great having, there was obviously like pianos and guitars dotted around, but I was never really allowed to use them because I'd kind of abuse them. And so I get told off. But the more I got told off, the more I wanted to do it. And so in the end, I was like bunking off school to go back home when I knew he was away, just so that I could creep into the house and plug the guitars in.
Wicked.
But I'd get told off because he'd know, because all the he'd come back and the strings would be rusty, you know, like sweat all over it and make a mess of them, you know. And so, but actually, when looking back, I was thinking this morning that probably the earliest sort of bit of recording, the thing that obviously had, because he had sort of a four track and a little setup at home, but was always going off to studios I remember in the 80s he brought back, it was when sort of all the tape machines sort of started, you could record on on just a basic tape machine, you know, so you could record stuff off the radio. And so I would have been about maybe nine or so, and I remember he showed me how to record stuff on the radio. So it's like you'd listen to the top 40.
It
was just like, wow. And I can rewind it. And I think the first thing was Dexy's Midnight Runner track, Gino. That was it. And it was the only one I liked on the thing. But I was about to rewind it, play it. You know, and then it was like, all right, I'd wait for next week's one, wait for the top 40 and go, all right, I'm going to get this one.
And make
a mixtape from that, you know.
Amazing.
And then, eventually we got one with two decks, you know, two tape machines.
You could copy your mixtape from your friends. And then
mixtapes became a thing. And then that's how that started. And then when finally I was allowed to use the four track, and then I was off, really. But actually, by that time, I was in the census things, and we started when we were kind of like 12-ish around there. We met at Adventure Playground, and we heard that there was a guy who used to come to the Adventure Playground called Mark, who had a Fender Telecaster. So he had to be in the band.
Yeah. A real Fender Telecaster.
A real one, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so was that the very first time... I suppose, therefore, the census things was a bit of a lot of firsts for you then. Was that the first time you went into a studio to record properly?
Yeah. I mean, we'd save up all our pennies and to go and record like some real basic sort of what would have been an 8-track or, you know, reel-to-reel back then. Reel-to-reel. I thought it was my phone. It's a sheet.
That's right.
It would have been real basic. Yeah, 8-track sort of reel-to-reel studios. I think there was one called Toad Hall that was run by some miserable old guy who hated us because we were terrible, you know, at the end of the day. But it needs must. And it's just that's how you started. But it was all tape, really, back then.
Yeah. So what was... What was the first time you worked with a producer when you were a musician and you went into a studio with an actual producer, rather than like, you know, the local guy that owns the studio?
Well, it was always that for quite a while until maybe, that's a good question, actually. I'd have to think about that. It might, maybe Ralph Jezzard. No, we, it would have been. Like we went in with a few people, actually, before before we did album projects, because we did a couple of EPs along the way. But actually, I can't really remember. I'd have to fill, we'd have to fill that one in. I'd have to call the drummer. He might remember.
Phone a friend.
Phone a friend.
I don't think I've ever had a phone a friend on the podcast before.
And actually, as I'm thinking about it, yeah, we did work with quite a few over the years. I'm sure there's a few names. We could maybe add to that.
Yeah. I can't imagine there's many modern producers you haven't worked with now.
Yeah, been around, yeah, I've crossed paths with quite a few. Yeah.
I mean,
it was nice where I went further down the line when I used to go sort of before tours would start with the Muse guys. I'd often sort of, because there'd be a gap, but they'd go off and do it. I wouldn't get involved with the recording because they'd just do it all themselves and more than capable. They don't need me getting in the way. But I'd come down towards the end of the session just to see, just sort of, but you know, how it's all going, and have a catch up and listen to the mixes. And I think, yeah, there was one, I think it was Spike Stent was doing one in Italy. I can't remember which album, but I flew over there and it was in Lake Como at Matt's place, the singer. And it's just a beautiful place, much like this place, but by the lakes and all that stuff, by the lake. And they were all, you know, drinking rosé on the terrace, exactly what you'd imagine, just having a lovely time, album finished. And it's like, right, so, you know, do you want to come and listen to the album? It's like, no, absolutely not. I'm looking around, I'm on the lake, I think we should go, you know, I'm quite happy here.
Yeah,
you know,
looking. I don't want to go into
and Spike
studio.
Was like, absolutely fucking right. Yeah, who wants to go back in there?
No, you know, no one wants to go.
You're going to be listening to this for the next 2 years.
Yeah,
so.
Right, and playing it every night. So, you were talking about the whole sort of getting into recording very, very early.
Yeah.
Like, when, I mean, was it always with you?
Yeah, I think it was, like I say, because it was sort of around, you know, there was the sort of four, at that time, four tracks were just a thing, and, and they were kind of affordable, and anyone with a guitar amp and an interest could fit it in, you know, and it was they were small enough that you could have a little setup in the corner, and a lot of people did. And I remember we used to go down to Cornwall with the Townsends, like I said earlier, on like family holidays and that. And there was a guy called Ian Dunlop, who had a lovely house in sort of South Cornwall. And he played with Graham Parsons back in the day, in the 60s, a lovely guy. He was a fisherman stroke musician, but he had this fantastic mill and like real magical place. And so that's where we used to go and hang out when we were kids. But he gave me the keys to the mill, which is where he had his own setup with a it was like a lovely water mill. It was great. He had a four track set up, and he just left me there for a week in the holidays while he did his thing. And I just lost myself. And I think that time that I spent that week really kind of nailed it, as far as I was sort of obsessed by then.
Yeah.
The whole idea of playing something and adding something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so he had a little 808 sort of drum machine type thing, one of those really early Roland things, I think. And it was just like, right, okay.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, awful. But it didn't really matter. It was just the understanding of layering stuff up, which is just fascinating, and still is. I still love it. It's still once you start down that road, it's just there is a slightly sort of addictive thing. It's just magical every time. You never know what you're going to get.
Yeah,
I mean, I love recording. Still love recording drums, because even with the same kit that I've got in the room, it's always different. There's always, you're always sort of looking at different, you're always looking at different ways of doing it, and it's unique. You know, that's what's great about recording, you know.
I mean, the fact that you've had recording in your life forever, from the first point of being a musician.
Mm.
I mean, a lot of musicians I've spoken to and songwriters, the songwriting comes first, the playing the instrument comes first, and then later on down the line, they end up kind of getting a laptop with Logic, etc.
Yeah,
and that's when it starts coming into their lives. And I've often asked people about how does it revolutionise your songwriting, but have you ever written as a songwriter without the accompaniment of recording?
Yeah, well,
you know, when you're on your own?
Yes. Well, when I did a lot of touring, I started, there was a period when early with the Muse guys, I think it might have even been before that, but I used to get quite tired of not having it. I'd get bored, essentially. Mm. And so I kept looking at different ways of without just getting drunk and all the normal stuff, but, you know, of just hotel room, you know, without watching TV. So what I ended up doing was taking guitars away with me, which is a pain in the ass. But eventually I've worked out that I found a baritone ukulele in a guitar shop, which was just the right size to put in the hold, in above, yeah, you know, as carry-on luggage. It wasn't plinky like a tenors and soprano or whatever, the little, you know, like George, yeah, Formby type plinky, yeah, plinky thing. But it was like almost like a, so it's a four string, but it's like a nylon strung, and it was quite rich because it's the bass version.
Yeah.
Anyway, so one thing led to another. I started getting obsessed with writing on it. And so I wrote tons of stuff on that. And without recording virtually any of it, I mean, eventually I started taking laptops and stuff with me.
Yeah.
And keeping notes of stuff. But yeah, that was, and that actually kept me going for about 15 years, really, all the way through Muse. I'd have gone mad, I think, without it.
How many songs did you write on tour with Muse?
On this thing?
Yeah, just in general on your laptop, just staying away from the boredom on tour.
Hundreds. Yeah. Yeah, just hundreds of riffs and bits and bobs. Which would never get you, but it didn't really matter. It was more about just staying sane, you know. And that's a lot of waiting around, a lot of hotel rooms.
Yeah.
You know, that was, I think I did about 650 gigs with them.
Wow.
And over that period, but you know, add to that the travel days,
yeah,
add to that the rehearsals, yeah, the TV shows, all the other nonsense.
They're a busy band.
Yeah, still are, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, now you've decided to just sort of chill out on the touring after spending an entire lifetime of doing it.
Yeah, I paid my dues.
I don't think there's much more you can probably see or do on a stage now, really.
No, I mean, sometimes I do sort of miss it, but actually, well, I'm really enjoying the recording side of it at the moment. I've got a nice little sort of setup and working with lots of young bands.
Well, that's it. I wanted to ask you about Decatone.
Yeah, so after lockdown, obviously touring just kind of stopped in its tracks. And so during lockdown, I had a studio at home that I'd built over the years, but it was just a small setup, you know.
What was the sort of recording rig? What was the gear on that side?
It was all just based on Logic. I had nice Shadow Hills eight mic pre's, I picked up some nice stuff from America when the dollar was a bit, you know, kinder. And so I had Shadow Hills mic pre's. I got a nice Wonder CM7 vocal mic and some good converters, some JCF converters. They're sort of custom things. And because I went through a phase of recording to tape, but going into Pro Tools converters just sounded awful. It sounded like they were broken. And so I've spent a bit of money on getting it's only 8 in, that's it. But so everything going in, all the, you know, important stuff to me, is sort of as good as it's going to get, really.
Yeah.
And so that was quite a small setup. Not an awful lot of outboard. I had a studio prior to that in Shepherd's Bush, maybe about 20 years ago, and collected quite a lot of outboard. But over the years, I've kind of downsized it to almost like a mastering setup, really.
Okay.
And enough channels to do drums and everything that I need. But it's quite minimal, really.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of it, really.
And you do all your own stuff in there now. You don't have a separate, like... a studio, a home, because that Decatone's separate from your house.
It is now, yes. So Decatone, sorry, yes. So during lockdown, a friend of mine who had a studio up the road by Twickenham Studios, where they filmed all the Get Back stuff.
Cool.
So just behind that, there's a little load of workshops, old Victorian style. It's like an old sort of, you know, old street, almost like a Dickensian street. That's what it looks like. So it's just in the middle of nowhere. And anyway, so this guy, he'd had enough of it. He wanted to move out of town. And so I took it over. So it happened all kind of very naturally. I was thinking I wanted to do more studio stuff, mm-hmm. and was doing more studio stuff. And so Decatone sort of kind of came out of that, really.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I've been working with helping a charity called the Basement Door Charity that looks after a lot of bands in Southwest London. All the young bands, mm-hmm. and pretty much all of them would go through this charity, and it's a really good, great setup. They help with the lights, they help with setting up gigs, and they put gigs on them. There's like a battle of the bands thing every year, it's just a constant flow of young musicians getting back into playing. And of course, over lockdown, there was a lot of musicians had time on their hands to get to know their instruments and write, and so we're seeing the profits of that a little bit,
which is
fantastic. And what's great about the young bands coming through, and it's everything from rap stuff to rock and roll to metal to whatever, and sometimes a mix of all of it, which is quite interesting.
What was that band you were talking about the other day that you did that you were really excited about?
there was one that was I think they've changed their name recently. What are they called? Where Are They Now or something? I don't know. But they came in and they started off playing sort of middle of the road, sort of almost Eagles type tracks, but then when it would drift, it would sort of segue randomly into Slayer, which is great. And it just made me laugh, you know. And it's things like that. But without batting an eyelid, it was just because their reference points are just all over the place, not like... You know, stuck in our sort of mum's record collections. You know, days of old. You know, just being able to have YouTube at your fingertips is sort of a whole other world. I couldn't imagine having that at, you know, 16.
Yeah,
it'd just be blowing my mind. I wouldn't know what to do.
We listen to John Peel.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it imagine the music we would have made if.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It's sort of sometimes, I do wonder if it's sort of saturated, you know, to a degree. But out of it, yeah, there's some interesting stuff coming out.
Yeah.
And the musicianship of a lot of the young kids is way better than I remember being at that age.
Yeah. An interesting thing I thought, I mean, doing this Vent record with you, is that one thing I love.
You think we'd be able to play better by now?
There is that. I would have thought you'd have sorted your shit out by now.
Should have learned something. Yeah.
No, yeah. But it's the one thing I love is that obviously between all three of you, you've all had lengthy careers in the music industry, but there's that boyish passion about it. And I think that's really important. And I suppose working with, to a certain degree, I think working with younger bands, I think that keeps me in touch with the passion. I like being in a room with a band that are just like mega hungry.
Yeah.
And just
absolutely.
You feed off it, don't you?
It is good fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
When it's good, it's good.
It is. Yeah.
And they're not as jaded yet as the rest of us.
Well, exactly. But I know. I think you've managed to maintain that and not be jaded. I'm lucky. I work with a lot of people that are the same. Occasionally I work with people that are literally like, yeah, so before we've even started any of the guitars, whatever, like, so what time do you think we're going to be finished today?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's understandable. If you've been in a band for like 25, 30 years, it can get like that, you know?
Yeah.
But I do, I think it is a massive advantage to purposely stay passionate and stay youthful about it in the studio, because it's so easy, like you said, that like the grumpy fuck that sits there in the studio and just doesn't want to work with
that's you. What I really did when I set the studio up, I really didn't want to be that person. I've kind of really tried hard, and I probably have drifted into that person a little bit from time to time. I was telling you the other day about the guy who took all the skins off the drum kit that I was furious before we'd even started the session. It's like, what the fuck are you doing? Put it all back exactly how it was. But apart from that, no, generally it's you know, I think I've been quite lucky with my little run of bands so far. They've all been very well behaved,
so. You're due a nightmare soon.
Yeah, I'm probably due a nightmare.
You've got to have one.
I mean
going back to that thing of all the years of studio experience you've had from working with lots of people, the thing is, when you work in the studio yourself and you have a background knowledge and a strong knowledge of the studio world, I think, because I was always into it really young.
Yeah.
You know, I started getting into it when I was about 15. It kind of paralleled my interest in being in a band.
Yeah.
And it's an important part of people's careers. You spend a lot of time in the studio. So in that studio environment, who would you, have you got anybody that you would say was probably one person that was hugely influential on you, that you came away from one particular studio session thinking, okay, that's really opened it up for me?
Well, I don't really, there isn't anyone who stands out hugely as far as as an individual.
Everybody was mediocre.
Everyone was. But I mean, the guy that I initially spent the most time with would have been Ralph Jezzard on one of the Senseless Things albums, because we had the luxury of time, and we were, luxury of time more than you would do now. And being able to, you know, so you'd sign your deal and you'd go in, you'd rehearse, get the album together, and then you'd go in and you'd record it, and you'd spend it over, you know, a few weeks or maybe even a month if you're really lucky. And you'd be in a nice studio with a, you know, with a reel to reel and a desk and the whole bit. And so that's probably where we learned, you know, the most about just the structure, the whole structure of putting an album together.
Did he do Empire of the Senseless?
Yes. So there was Ralph, and he was great. He was just like a mate, really, as well. Mm-hmm. And he was a lot of fun to be with. But he kept us sort of kind of in the right, you know, in the right space. He was kind of one of us, but you know, kind of kept us out of trouble.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
So did he inspire you? Like, obviously, the process, but also engineering-wise, technically, did you?
Well, he was encouraging. That was the thing as well, which is always helps, you know. So I think on the last album, I think it would have been the last album, maybe the last two. At that point, ADATs had become a thing, so I had an ADAT. I had a setup at home, and I was playing Hammond organ, just because I just loved it. I'm a terrible organ player, but not, you know, not a great keyboard player by any stretch, but I just loved the sound of it. And so I was playing a lot at home, writing stuff just for myself, really, you know, had no plans to be the next Booker T or anything, you know. So I started writing stuff for the album, and he was encouraging, saying, right, okay, we'll just go, you know, I'm going to stripe the, you know, an ADAT machine. And we're going to sync it up, and it's like you can do it at home. So I recorded quite a lot of Hammond, and experimented quite a bit on those records. We didn't use all of it because it was quite experimental. but you can hear some of it. But that was all done at home, and so that was it picked up a little bit by then.
And then we
started recording friends' bands, you know, at home, and the early De La Cota records that. Album that was released was kind of the pre-album was done at my place. There was a few mates bands, the Revs, we did a they were like a mod band.
I remember the Revs,
And we were kind of just learning our way, really. And but also it was kind of an exciting time, because at the same time computers were becoming a thing, so ADATs had been around for a little while, but then we heard Tony from the Gay Bikers on Acid, over in Hammersmith, who lived with our driver, the Senseless Things driver, had got hold of a computer and was managing to make music with a thing called a sampler.
Right.
And it was all very complicated and looked very scary. It was on a black and white screen.
Yeah.
But eventually we got into that, and so we got our sampler, and we got, you know, and so we were linking up. It was a nightmare, really. It was all floppy disks and ADATs and errors and...
It's a 3-inch...
It was a labour of love, I tell you. Yeah. That was hard work to
save
get
a
stuff
song
done.
On a sampler, you'd need about five disks.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It was amazing that we got anything done at all, really. Yeah.
So when did you make the switch to computer? When did you get your first Logic rig?
Well, it was not long after that. It was around when I was playing with in the De La Cosa band. We after they'd put a record out, then they got their own studio, and then we set everything up. We got into Logic. I got Logic. And it was very basic, you know, early days. So it would have been the very first version.
Did you have a Motu interface?
We had something like that.
Everybody had Motu then.
It was something like that. Yeah. In fact, and the converters were so rubbish. What I used to do was I had a DAT machine that was okay, and use the converters. All the vocals we'd use the converters via the DAT machine. So we made it even more complicated for ourselves.
I had something like that. I had, I can't remember how I did it exactly, but I needed to get 24 ins. And the way I did it was that I used an ADAT, you know, the HD ADATs when they went to the hard drive ones.
Yeah, right.
And I light piped that and I had my 24 ins into that.
Yeah,
and
then clocking that would have been fun.
Oh, it used to go out all the time.
Yeah,
and nightmare. Just prang out.
Well, I've got to tell you this, October, there was a funny story when we were... So me and my friend Paul, who was my best mate and helped my sort of engineer, as it were. We kind of co-engineered everything around that time. We had to set up the Gorillaz, the Delicota set up, which was the drummer who went on to be the drummer for the Gorillaz, Cass. He had Cakewalk. Right. So I was on Logic, but he decided to go on Cakewalk. I had no idea how it worked. So this would have been before I had Logic, because we didn't know, you know, it was our first go on a computer, and so it was left in my house. And so we'd kind of, so Cass would write all these beats and samples that would link to this 950 sampler. All we could see was the piano roll page, right? And so we thought and so it was just pink blobs.
Mm-hmm.
So this is alien to us, right? Bear in mind, we've never seen anything like this. It's just alien. So you could see where they would press play and it would stop. And it would fire off, you know, so a pink blob would fire off a sample. But only Cass knew what those pink blobs represented. They're not named because it's a piano roll, right? And so it was just like Braille. It looked like a sort of Braille type thing moving along. And one day, so we're just over summer, right? We've been recording, it was a hot summer, and we've been recording all summer in a sweaty old basement, you know. And I'm looking at Paul, and Paul's looking at me going, you know what, there's got to be a better way than this. This just is ridiculous. I mean, because we're trying to work on it while Cass wasn't there. And just to press play and load up, it's just a nightmare. And we're looking at it going, hang on a sec. And so we get the mouse and start sort of, you know, tentatively playing, you know, moving things around. And Paul grabbed a bit of the screen and just moved it over. And there's the arrange page. Like, for fuck's sake, you fucking... Well, I was furious. I just wanted to stop the session. The amount of time that we could have saved if we'd known. Just by knowing...
How long had you been working?
Months. If you didn't know, you didn't know. Who'd know? You know.
I suppose there wasn't forums.
No, it's like we didn't know anyone else. You know, there's nothing like that. I mean, now you'd go on YouTube and you'd never be in that situation. But it was funny. We still laugh about that. Yeah, I mean, Paul nearly lost his shit that day.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine.
Yeah.
So when you're, have you got, you know, when you go into, you wear two hats now, obviously, right? So you're here recording as an artist.
Yeah.
And then there'll be other times that maybe next week you'll be going into the studio.
Yeah.
And you're the producer.
Yeah.
So do you have like kind of different needs? Do you like things? Do you have like, okay, if I'm an artist, I like the studio to run like that. And as a producer, I like the day to run like that. Or is it the same?
It's pretty much the same, really. Yeah. I mean, the luxury of writing at the studio is sort of kind of minimal, really. I don't often get much of a chance to do that. I have to really sort of consciously book myself in. And then it's just sort of pretty frantic. I'm just trying to do as much as I can as quickly as possible. And then tidy up for the next lot to get in, you know.
Do you have a like, I need my workflow to be like this. No, I like, you know.
It's totally random. Depends what I'm doing. Yeah, depends what I'm doing. If I'm doing sort of a bass thing. I tend to sort of actually I've got it set up in the studio so I can pretty much go from one thing to the other pretty quickly. Because that's how, it's not a huge studio by any means, but the way that I've got it to work is pretty fluid. So the bands, for the most part, the bands can come in and just get going.
Uh-huh.
So the kit's locked down.
Uh-huh.
So I've got some great stuff built by Aid Emsley from Orange, some custom bits and pieces, which is all sort of, so for guitars and bass, we're kind of sorted.
Yeah, yeah.
It just sounds good straight away before we even get into plugging amps in, you know, so you're up and running pretty quick.
Yeah.
The only thing I'm missing at the moment is I can't get the Hammond up the stairs, which is a real pain. The B3 won't fit, so I'm trying to work out, we were talking about donating it to Vader.
Well, we could look after it for you.
I'm sure.
I think there'd be a lot of people that would be very happy. It's funny, it's one thing that I'm actually consciously trying to develop is the key side of all the stuff we've got. We've got loads of backline,
yeah,
loads of drum kits, loads of guitar.
Well, we should definitely talk about that. I mean, it's a shame because it's not being used at the moment. It's just sat there gathering dust and probably needs a bit of a service, but it's a lovely old piece. I mean, it's just, and it's the one that John Bundrick Rabbit used with the Who over all the way through the 70s.
Oh, wow.
But because of that, it didn't get an awful, it only got played during the gigs. Mm-hmm. The rest of the time was in storage. So, so it's the contact bar's pretty good in it, which a lot of them suffer from. But yeah, so it's a good one. And it's got a wah-wah built in, so well, there you go.
Yeah, yeah. You've had a couple of problems with it, though, haven't you, recently?
I've got two. I've got a little L100 at my mum and dad's place down in Lyme Regis, and that's where I did the last bit of recording. But yeah that's sick as a dog, that one.
It's smoking,
and smelled disgusting as well.
I think I might be a bit of an unlucky charm, because the famous graphite bass...
The moment it arrived
at Vader.
Yeah, literally after however long, 35 years or something.
I saw you play that bass, and was it that Reading thing that I'm staring at right now? Was it 92?
I would have bought that, bought the bass probably, it would have been 89, I think. I had that bass ordered. And it's been a bit of a... It's been great up until we started the vent session. and then it stopped. I brought the pickup down, right down to the metal.
I've never seen that before.
Through the whatever you call it. What is it? The plastic, I guess.
Yeah, just through being a bad boy. Well, you play so hard. I love... let me explain this to people that's listening. So he plays so hard. Obviously, those who know him, the strings over the pickup had obviously been touching them. And they've worn the plastic right down to the metal.
Yeah, and shorted it. But the timing was extraordinary, really, after all these years. Mm. And it was within a couple of minutes, wasn't it, really?
Seconds.
Yeah.
Have you done everything with that bass? Did you play with the Streets in that and the Gorillaz?
And the Who session that we did for the Olympics, that was all done on that, yeah.
You played bass for Muse once, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I stood in for a little segment of a tour. Which one would that have been? Black Holes, I guess. Chris broke his wrist playing football, and I was in with the Streets at the time, and I was in Europe somewhere, and I got a call from the tour manager who I knew from back in the day anyway, and he said, "Oh, look, you know, Chris has broken his wrist. Can you come and help us out?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, when is it?" It's like, "Next week." I was like, "What's it for?" It's like a festival. It's like, "How many is that?" It's like 80,000 or whatever it was. It's like a headline, so it's a big deal. And I was like, "Well, I can't. I'm in Europe. I'm with the Streets." And he said, "Well," and I said, "Well, I can't, you know, go and ask someone else." And I was like, "I'll tell you what, I'll have a think and I'll get back to you." And he said, "Look, no, they want you to do it because Chris is, you know, he's sort of a bit of a fan, and the whole sound, it's a sort of bottom end, top end distortion thing. And I think they needed someone."
I've often thought that they were inspired by you.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. And so they needed somebody who could deal with that whole rig, mm-hmm. I guess. And so... I turned it down a couple of times, and then eventually I said to Dom, the tour manager, I said, "Look, you know, the only way I'm going to do it is if you make me an offer I can't refuse." And then they did. So I called up Mike, you know, like 10 minutes later, just from the Streets, and said, "Listen, mate, I hate to be a pain in the ass, but I'm going to have to go and do this." And he was like, being lovely as he is, he was just like, with all the best will. So.
Oh, that's nice.
So, yeah, and so I ended up touring with them for a couple of, for a month or so. Went to Australia, and Chris got better, Arm got better, and poor guy was bored out of his mind anyway. And so for the rest of the tour, I became sort of beer monitor and party organiser.
Well, so, I don't think there's many people that are better for the job.
So which is a role that I've kind of embraced, which is, you know, and did as much as I could.
I imagine if there was an ombudsman or something, I think you'd probably like win awards.
But anyway, so we all got on, and yeah. And then so I went back to the streets, and then they happened to be doing an album, the next album, whatever it was. It was at the Townhouse, which was just down the road from my studio in Shepherd's Bush. Mm-hmm. It was like literally, you know, a street away. Uh-huh. And they happened to be there. And so they started doing a lot more synth stuff. They wanted to get more into synths and bring the stuff up to date a little mm-hmm. bit, as it were. And Matt called and said, oh, you know, how's it going? And, I don't suppose you can play keyboards. And I said, and I sort of lied and said, yeah. And he said, well, where are you now? And I said, well, I'm in Shepherd's Bush. And he said, well, I'm in Shepherd's Bush. Where, you know, and I was like, where are you? The Townhouse. And so I'm literally around the corner. And so he came down and I had to be there. And I had the Hammond all set up. And he said, well, play some keyboards. And I played a bit in C. Did my one scale in C.
Yeah.
And he said, that'll do. Fine, you're in the band.
Brilliant. Well, to impress him as a keyboard player, there's...
Well, he's a pretty serious keyboard player, yeah. And piano player, yeah. And so obviously I was never going to be doing anything of that.
No.
So what he really wanted is just someone to play all the synth lines, which is all basic top lines, really. There's very little left hand. The occasional, I think the most complicated thing I had to play was Feeling Good on Hammond, which was which is not exactly tough particularly, but. I made it as tough for myself as possible, probably.
Did you ever fuck it up?
Always, yeah. Yeah. But that's a good thing about Hammond. It's sort of less is more. You know? Yeah.
So in your vast experience of studio time, right? Yeah. This is the golden moment where people can get juicy.
Right.
Your best and worst moments in the studio. And you're not allowed to do, I'll have to have a think, I can't remember, or I have to phone a friend. This is on the spot, right now.
Well, one of the best, okay, straight off the bat, was the Senseless Things. I remember Ben, the guitarist, the lead guitarist, if we could call him that, had just been spending his publishing advance, which was... wasn't too bad, I think, at the time. We managed to, because back in the days of actually getting an advance. And so he went off and bought a Gibson Les Paul, very shiny thing that he was very, very proud of, and brought it into the studio and was all ready to do his, you know, his lead parts for the next, you know, 4 days or whatever it was going to take him. And sorry, I'm being a nasty Ben, I'm sorry, love you dearly. But then he, on the way to, after his first solo on his new guitar, caught the lead on the way into this control room, brought it over and down it went and off went the neck.
Oh no!
And we laughed. Oh, how we laughed. He'd been going on about this bloody guitar for ages. So that was entertaining.
And what was his reaction?
I mean,
that's
the sort of nasty people we were back then.
I was going to say, did he cry? I've seen people cry when their guitars.
Yeah, no, he was horrified. But we did. Yeah, that was kind of fun.
And that's your favourite moment, ladies and gentlemen, Morgan Nichols.
I don't know what made me think of that, but it did make me laugh at the time.
It was
a moment.
Yeah, love that.
Worst moment. That's hard, actually. Having a worst moment in a studio. I guess early days, being sort of told off or being put under pressure. When you're very young, I'm trying to think of a good example, but I know it happened, and I can't think. I remember being, you know, like hyperventilating, uncomfortable, and put on the spot. Maybe doing backing vocals or something like that, or something. I don't know. Being in a studio under that when it's pressurized and you are on the spot, or if you can't do something, I guess that may have been early on. And then seeing the mist, you know, that mist that you can get where you can't see any further now. And you're just gone. There is no getting out of it. You know, it's almost like, you know, squaring up to a fight when you know you're going to come off worse.
Yeah.
It's sort of kind of that sort of feeling, the mist.
Yeah.
And I can't really remember a specific time, but I know that I would have been in that situation. And I think that whatever that situation, I've probably erased it from my mind a little bit. And that, coming back to working with the young bands, is sort of key for the not being like that and wanting to and being encouraging. Because I have seen that in other in kids coming in. A lot with bass players, funny enough. a lot of the bass players I find struggle with that, where they can literally go from I can play this kind of to this is not going to work.
Mm.
You know, it's like they've never played before.
Yeah,
you know, and just nerves, just
yeah.
pure nerves.
Yeah, the
you know?
Meltdown thing. I mean, there are some producers out there that are quite bullyish yeah. with their tactic.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it used to be, I mean, that was a thing back in the day, apparently. My dad's always saying about some of the sessions, sessions at Olympic and before that Regent Sound and stuff,
mm.
and back in the sort of Cheryl Tammy days when it really was the white coat thing.
Mm.
And the engineers, you weren't allowed in the studio.
Yeah.
You played, and then that was it. The engineers would engineer their thing
in
their white coats in the lab, yeah. you know. And, yeah. But there's a funny story, now, I don't know how true it is, but back in the Who days, apparently, so Pete was showed quite a lot of interest in recording very early on and was finally allowed into the actual control room one day and spent an afternoon and obviously asked all the right questions and was allowed back in occasionally. And after another session, Rogers said, can I come in? They said, no.
Keep the fucking singer out of the control room.
Don't let him in.
No.
It was made me laugh. But it was a bit, so there was a bit, sort of, I don't know, maybe it's sort of some of the old Brigade sort of kind of still had that sort of thing. I remember actually saying that. So the BBC, I remember recording a lot of the Peel sessions back in the day. We did quite a few of them.
Mm-hmm. Is that Maid of Vale?
Yeah. And so I'm just trying to remember, there was one guy down there who used to play in a famous band. He was a producer, and the producer was one of the guys who did all those sessions
mm-hmm.
for Peel. And oh my God, what's his name? You'd know his name. He was in, like, I don't know, but he was quite grumpy.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he put you in your place.
Right.
He didn't suffer fools at all. And it was quite harsh.
Yeah.
You know, took it very seriously, but then, you know, I guess you're in the BBC, you got to, but looking back, it was sort of unnecessary.
Yeah. Bit of dick swinging.
Yeah. I wonder if that's actually, now I'm thinking about it, maybe it was there that I got put into a bit of under pressure and sort of lost my shit, but I don't think it was. I think it was maybe before then, but
As through your adult recording life, you've breezed it.
Yeah. Although, Matt, saying that, I've did a few recordings with the Muse guys and obviously a lot of rehearsing in studios. And that could be quite pressurised.
Yeah.
It was different with them because it would be being asked to play guitar and keyboards and vocals and percussion and remember everything all the time.
Yeah.
Over quite a lot. But towards the end, the catalogue was getting bigger and bigger. And so I'd have, like, you know, 60 tracks all sort of set up in main stage and randomly we'd have to dig them out because the computer could only hold so many.
Right.
With all the various synths and all the sounds and the sort of samples, it's quite a lot of work. Mm. So sometimes it'd be quite daunting, especially if Matt decides, like he would, just before going on stage in front of 50,000 people, that he wants to do a track that he haven't played for, like, 6 years. Like, shit. Great, nice one. Cheers, Matt. But you do it, and it'd be seat of the pants or whatever you call it.
It gets you to up your game, right?
Yeah.
I imagine working with Matt Bellamy because of his excellence, musically.
Something else, really.
It is something else. And I think it would naturally make any musician raise their game.
Yeah,
and especially for a musician like you, I don't think there's many people out there that could probably push your limits. So it must have been quite nice, you know, to like push the max.
Well,
you know.
He's beyond that. I mean, it's like you're just keeping up as best you can.
Yeah,
he's phenomenal musician, and I think there's that thing about a lot of musicians will just use up one half of their brain. You know, like most musicians would, because there's the people who can't read music but will just can improvise.
Yeah.
You know, which is a fact, isn't it? Mm. You know, and then there's people who can notate and do, and the math side of it, they're very comfortable and great at writing, but quite often can't improvise.
So. Yeah.
Matt is, I think that I read somewhere that a lot of the great classical composers were very much the same, but on, you know, next level stuff. Mm. And I think he is definitely on that. On that tip, because he can do both, like, you know,
scoring.
Oh my God, it's just he's a whole package, really. But also, what's great about Matt is he's quite happy to pull his pants down and wave his ass in front of you, at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he's got, he's a good fun, he's fun to be around.
Yeah.
You know, he's eccentric and a lovely guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Miss him.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Well, Morgan, it's been so amazing having you on the podcast. And we probably need to now go over to the studio and make some more of this record with the boys.
Yeah,
otherwise, we'll get in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, we could do this all day, though.
Yeah, it's been really lovely. Yeah, it's been really lovely. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, anytime.
And yeah, let's go make a record.
Yes, do it.